Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. It's a bit of an early Arscast, I know, but it's been such a quiet week. And we don't hear from Mikel Arteta ahead of the Chelsea game until tomorrow. I thought I would put this one out. It's kind of timeless anyway. So it gives you something to listen to on a Thursday before things pick up ahead of our game against Chelsea on Saturday evening. It was my pleasure this week, yesterday in fact, to talk to a genuine Arsenal legend, Liam Brady. He has a brand new book out. It's called Born to Be a Footballer. He was in Dublin for the launch of that book, the Irish launch of that book, last night. So we met up yesterday afternoon and had a good old chat about the book itself, his time at Arsenal, the ups and downs, his move to Italy, the work he did at Arsenal as head of youth development, and lots more besides. Stay tuned for a bit more after, but right now, this is me and Liam Brady.
Free waiting again for the cross from Price. Stapleton. Oh, Pat Rice in there. Oh, Brady won it beautifully. Look at that! Oh, look at that!
Okay, well, it's my pleasure to be sitting in a Dublin hotel room with an Arsenal legend, Liam Brady. Hello.
Hi, Andrew.
Your book, Born to Be a Footballer, is out now. This isn't the first book you've written, though, or been involved in. You tell a story fairly early on about a book that was produced in your 20s. What made you decide to go again and do something else?
Well, the first book was a bit of a disaster, in as much as that it got me sued by a journalist who didn't take kindly to what I said about him in the book. It made absolutely nothing. And I ended up in the High Court in London defending myself against the libel case.
Right.
That kind of put me off doing a book for many, many years. But during lockdown, it was Nick Callow, who I think it's an open secret. Nick is quite a big Arsenal supporter.
Sure.
And he convinced me to go again. And this time I felt I had a story. First time around, had a bit of a cheek doing a book at 24 years of age. But I was advised by my agent at the time that it would be a good thing to do, but it wasn't. So here we are, like 50 odd years in playing football, 52 years since I joined Arsenal. And, you know, I've had a long and career in probably most forms of the game, as a player, as a manager, as head of youth development, as a pundit, as a watcher. So I felt I had something to write this time round.
How did you find the process of getting it all down? You know, you mentioned Nick, and I know you had a bit of help from Larry Ryan from the Examiner as well. But in terms of the process of getting the book done and getting the words down on paper, how was that?
Well, it was something to do during lockdown. You know, everybody had situations in their personal lives where there wasn't a lot to do. We weren't working. We couldn't go anywhere apart from maybe go outside for a walk. So it gave me a focus, and I researched it. I rang a lot of people that I knew down through the years, ex-players, players I'd played against, for their recollections of things. And like, for instance, I rang Kevin Keegan, who was very, very good to me, and he explained to me why he went to Hamburg when he did, what was going on at Liverpool. It was something similar to my situation at Arsenal. And I spoke to managers, I spoke to players I played against, I spoke to players I played with. It was great reminiscing, because, as I say, it was very little to do during lockdown. Like, we had nearly 2 years of staying at home.
I mean, did you get a lot from the people that you spoke to that made you go, oh my God, I don't remember that, or, you know, I remember it differently, or, you know, how was that?
Well, for instance, you know, when I went from Arsenal to Juventus, I knew that I wasn't their first choice. But Keegan told me he was asked to join Why? Before me. I didn't know that. So, and then I spoke to Rummenigge about the fact that I didn't end up at Bayern Munich where I thought I was going to go. And he said to me, well, Paul Breitner wanted to play midfield, and he said to the powers to be at Bayern, we don't need Liam Brady, I'm going to play midfield. So all these kind of things came out, you know, as I was ringing people round. And then this Google and internet is brilliant, you know. If I wanted to remember a match or a game, the date, or you just type it into your iPad and bingo, it's up there, and sometimes you even see the highlights. And so it was an interesting process.
The book is called Born to be a Footballer, and you talk at the very start about the way sport was such a big part of your family life. Your brothers were very good footballers and Gaelic footballers. And I was wondering, you know, did you give any thought to the idea that talent runs in a family? Or, you know, is it maybe because you are from a very young age steeped in the sports that you're involved in that sort of brings out whatever talent you have?
Well, it must be some way in the genes, I think. You know, the fact that there was five sons and four of them ended up playing professionally, I think it tells you that there's something in the genes. Okay, we were madly in love with the game as we were growing up, all five of us. In fact, there was five sons. My brother Eamon went off to sea into the Merchant Navy. He tells me he could have been the best of the Brady family.
Of course, no evidence.
Yeah, there's very little evidence to support that. But it was steeped in the family, and I came late on the scene. My brothers were 20 years older than me, 20 and 19 years older than me, and they were already in England when I was a 2 or 3 year old. They'd already gone to England to play football, so I just wanted to emulate my big brothers.
I mean, it's a fairly well-worn path, isn't it? The sort of footballer going across the water. But you know, how did it start for you when Arsenal became interested in you and you have trials? And, you know, you, I think, said it was maybe a year and a half between the time that you were on trial for Arsenal and the time you were supposed to join Arsenal. I mean, do you remember that period of your life and thinking, okay, you know, you're still quite young. You were 15 when you went over. When you think about, you know, there's a difference now. I think people would view 15-year-olds differently now, perhaps, than back then. But what was it like in that period where you knew this big, big move was coming and a big sort of change in life did the fact that your brothers had gone over there and done that beforehand give you maybe a bit of a, not a security blanket, but a bit of comfort knowing that they'd gone there and done that and been successful?
Well, first of all, Andrew, I was a Manchester United fan, and that was the time of Georgie Best and Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law, and Man United winning in the league, I think, in 63, 67, European Cup in 68. I was 10, 11, 12 years of age. And Manchester United is a big club in Ireland because it always had Irish players in the team, you know, going back to the Munich air crash in 58 with Liam Whelan in the team. He was a Dublin lad. And then Johnny Giles, Tony Dunn in the 63 Cup final when United beat Leicester. So I was growing up as a Man United fan. And I thought I was told by the Man United scout just to be patient, and he'd get me over to United on trial. But Arsenal saw a bit of an opportunity. There was a man called Bill Darby who wrote to the chief scout of Arsenal at the time, Gordon Clark, and said, you know, dear Mr. Clark, Manchester United, I've just got the run of the place here. You know, there are lots of good kids in Dublin, who have lots of very good schoolboy footballers in Dublin, but Man United have the pick of them, and you should really think about changing this.
Who was that guy? Who was Bill Darby? Was he just somebody who was involved in football in Dublin? Was he a manager, or was he a coach somewhere, or was he just a guy with an eye for a player?
No, I'm not too sure whether he had an affiliation with any schoolboy club, but he just loved football and he loved watching kids playing. And he thought, well, you know, he showed some initiative by writing away. I don't think Arsenal were the only club he wrote to. He got a reply from Arsenal to say, okay, we hear what you're saying. We're going to send one of our trusted scouts over to Dublin to meet you and have a chat with you, and you take him to a match. And I happened to be playing in that game.
I mean, it's so fortuitous, isn't it? All the games he could have gone to in Dublin, of course.
Yeah, there must have been hundreds of games going on. But I think Malwyn Roberts was his name. He was a dear, dear man, became a dear friend of mine. And I was probably the best player he found, you know, so... He said to Bill, take me to the best game happening today. And we were top of the league. So I played for St. Kevin's. We were top of the league. I think we were playing a team that were up there with us. So that was the best game. And Malwyn liked me. And I only lived 5 minutes from the pitch we were playing on. And he found out where I lived. And he went around and knocked on my hall door. And the rest is history.
How was the trial, you know, to go over and, you know, to know that you're playing and you're being judged while you're playing? And that's obviously part and parcel of being a footballer, I suppose, particularly when you get to a professional level. Everything you do is being judged by coaches or managers or fans or pundits or whatever it might be. But at that age, was it easy to sort of put that to one side and just try and play in that game? Or, you know, especially maybe in a trial game where every single player is trying to impress, it can't be easy.
It's a long time ago now, so I don't exactly remember the circumstances, but I know I was nervous because, you know, you're waiting for this day to come. You know, it was very well organized up at London Colney. We're playing on a beautiful pitch. We had beautiful kits. We had all the scouts on the sideline, you know, the chief scout, and they're looking at these players and maybe, you know, trying to find maybe three or four in 22. And so it's a bit daunting, and I didn't start very well, but I turned it around the second half and had a really, really good game. And you can tell by the reaction of the Arsenal people around that you've done well, because they want to speak to you, they want to find out about you, you know, where you're from, you know, maybe big family, things like that. You get the attention if you do well. And, you know, I had my brother Eamon with me, and Eamon was living in London at the time, and he knew I'd done well. So, yeah, we were delighted, you know. I went back to Dublin knowing that I was going back to Arsenal.
I mean, you've worked in youth development, and we'll come on to that, but the difference now between how a young player, a young footballer is trained and how it happened back in your day is night and day, you know, in terms of the training, even just facilities and things like that, but also what's expected of you as a young professional, you know, the jobs you have to do, cleaning the boots, all that kind of stuff. Was that formative for you? Was that something that you think when you look back on, okay, that made me a bit stronger, I was able to learn from that, or was it just a pain in the hole?
It was a pain in the arse. there was better things to be doing football wise or educationally than cleaning the dressing rooms and scrubbing boots and cleaning the showers and the baths and things like that. You know, thankfully that doesn't exist anymore. But I think there was a belief back in the day that it was formative and it was good for you. Keep your feet on the ground and, you know, show how tough this game is. But we would have been far better off spending it developing our skills or developing our bodies or even going to school and having some more education.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the way it was. How quickly or how soon did you start flirting around with the first team in terms of training and things like that?
Well, you know, it was a situation then, and the older Arsenal supporters listening to this will remember that, you know, you had your youth games probably on a Saturday morning. But if you progressed, and I did, and at 16, maybe 16 and a half, I was playing reserve football. But in those days, reserve football took place at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. And if the first team were away, we got to play at Highbury. And there was men playing. You were playing against men when you played against in reserves. And I was in there probably at 16, 16 and a half. You know, I was playing with the likes of Charlie George, maybe John Radford, Peter Story, who coming back from injury or else they'd been left out of the team, things like that.
Yeah, because you didn't have many subs back then.
No, it was one sub, yeah. So, you know, the first team would maybe travel with 13 players rather than, you know, the entourage they go with now, probably about 22, 23. You got to play on a Saturday afternoon. You know, you were playing against men, and I did well, and I was doing well, and I was about 17 and a half. I would have been, it was October, funny enough, it was 50 years the other day when I made my debut.
Wow.
So it was October 6th, I think it was, and there's two dressing rooms at Highbury. There was the away dressing room and the home dressing room. We, because we weren't in the first team squad, used to change in the away dressing room. Yeah. And one of the lads who was cleaning, you know, I was now a professional, so I didn't have to clean dressing rooms anymore. But one of the lads who was cleaning the first team dressing room ran in and he said, "Chippy, your name's on the team sheet." I went, "What?" And I went in, and there it was, number 12, Birmingham City, the next day. And that was the start.
And what was your first start?
I was sub, and when you're sub, I was thinking, well, if hopefully we'll be winning well, maybe go two or three up, and I'll be brought on the last 15 or 20 minutes. Or things have gone badly. Bertie Mee was the manager then. Let's have a look at this kid. And it didn't happen like that. After 10 minutes, Jeff Blockley, who was the Arsenal centre-back at the time, he got injured and I was on. I was, you know, in at the deep end, sink or swim.
Yeah. Was that something, you know, as a competitor, is that something you relish? Because every footballer, I think, you know, regardless of age or level, you know, wants to play as much as possible. And the idea that a game might be, you know, a step up or a big challenge is an exciting one, I think.
Absolutely. It's what I was waiting for. You know, all through my probably career, you know, getting the knock on the door to say, would you let your son come to Arsenal on trial, to getting an apprenticeship at the club, to getting a pro contract at the club? These were all kind of things you were wanting to happen. So, you know, bring it on. When I got my chance in the first team, that's the way I looked at it. I had a really, really good game and actually kept my place for the following week against Spurs, where I had a lousy game, never kicked the ball, and we lost 2-0. So I was back in the resis for another couple of months. But I think I showed enough in that first game that I was going to get another chance. And that was the aim then, to get back in the team and to get out of the away dressing room into the first team dressing room.
At that time, football was hard. I think maybe a bit harder than it is now because of just the conditions that it was played in. The pitches weren't as good. The players certainly didn't get anywhere near as much protection as they do these days from the officials. And was it Tommy Smith who gave you some verbals at Anfield after you, I don't know if you went past him or whatever it was. But, you know, what's that like? What's that aspect of the game like, particularly when you're a young guy? And I guess if you're a young guy, you can play without fear and all those kinds of things. But if you've got someone like Tommy Smith, who, you know, looks like he could bend a steel pole in two, and he's telling you he's going to fucking break your legs, you know, how do you come to terms with that and that side of the game, and how much of what goes on the pitch do we as sort of ordinary fans not really understand in terms of the verbals and the sledging, if you want to call it that every bit of trying to get an advantage isn't just about what you do on the ball, it's about what you can do with somebody's mind.
Well, that went on, you know, intimidation, we call it. So, as you say, people or players could get away or an awful lot more than they can now. You know, one of Tommy Smith's early tackles on a player would probably be a red card now. But that was him telling you, you know, I'm Tommy Smith and, you know, you don't take liberties with me, you know. I knew what I was going out, because in the first team dressing room, when I was picked to play outside left against him. So they told me, watch yourself, you're up against Tommy Smith, you know. But you have no fear, you know. I took him on a few times. I got the better of him a few times, and then he warned me that, you know, if you're gonna carry on like this, you know, you might end up in Liverpool Infirmary.
But you didn't.
No, I didn't. Yeah. And I think once I showed what I could do that night, I was in that first team dressing room. You know, I was going to be in the squad, and I was going to be playing a lot more and so forth. So it was intimidating, but it wasn't a bridge too far.
Sure. You mentioned in the book early on there was a sort of some homesickness, and you went home and then you came back. But in the 70s at Arsenal, you know, and I know this because I was an Irish kid growing up in England, and people often ask me, like, why are you an Arsenal fan? I was born in Croydon, but grew up in Yorkshire. And people are saying, well, why are you an Arsenal fan? And the only thing I can think of, I don't ever remember choosing, but the only thing I can think of is like reading Shoot or all the football magazines that I was obsessed with back then. There's a club that has Liam Brady and David O'Leary and Frank Stapleton and John Devine, Pat Rice, Sammy Nelson, Pat Jennings, this Irish community at the club, if you want to call it that. And it does come across from what you write in the book that it was a community, even though there was, you know, at that stage, I didn't know the difference between North and South, you know, but nor did you guys experience that within the dressing room.
No, you know, I think Stephen Ray, the great Irish actor, was asked why he's an Arsenal supporter, and he said, well, it was the nearest thing to United Ireland team that there was around. And it was great, you know, and a lot of Arsenal fans, Irish Arsenal fans, became Arsenal fans because that was the situation, a bit like yourself, Andrew. So when we won the Cup in 79, there was an Irish flag on the front of the bus, you know. Yeah. You, where would you see that? I don't think you'd seen any club, you know, but there were so many Irish lads in the team. So It was a great time. We came in the late 70s under Terry Neal and Don Howe. We became a very, very good team. Three FA Cup finals on the trot, which was unheard of in those days, you know, to get to the cup final three times on the trot. A European Cup Winners' Cup final. Unfortunately, we ended up with too many silver medals and only one gold medal, but we were a very, very good team and there were great times at the club.
Yeah, and was that that Irishness in the dressing room, was that, how important was that for you guys? Or was it just, you know, a happy coincidence that, that you were there? You know, when you have a relationship with someone like Frank Stapleton, you know, who didn't grow up far away from you, David O'Leary, same thing, you know, do those relationships, or do you think those relationships, you know, bore out positively on the team and how you guys were able to play?
Well, it wasn't a coincidence in as much as that, you know, once I went to Arsenal, the club began to take Dublin very seriously. And then the following year, Frank was recruited. And then the next year, David O'Leary was recruited. A little bit after David, John Devine. And quite a few Irish players who didn't make it as well, you know, but there was a connection. So there wasn't a coincidence, but maybe the fact that we teamed up with Pat Rice and Sammy was a little bit, because they were homegrown players as well. Sammy's from Belfast. Pat was born in Belfast, but went over as a kid. Before he was a footballer, he went over as a kid with his family. And then Terry Neal made one of his greatest ever signings by signing Pat Jennings from Spurs. And there we were, like 6-7 of us. I don't think all seven ever played in a match. I think there might have been seven play in a game, but not together. I think John Devine might have come on for Sammy or vice versa in one of the games. So it was amazing, really amazing, but never happened again.
The three cup finals, 79 obviously is the one where success came, and that for me is, you know, the first game I can ever remember watching, first Arsenal game I can remember watching. I remember watching the 1978 World Cup final and being distraught that Holland hadn't won it and all the ticker tape and all the rest of it, but the Arsenal game, because football wasn't on TV back then. You know, you got the cup final and you got match of the day, but there was no live football on TV the way there is now. That final and that medal that you won that day, it must be something that you still look back on with a huge amount of pride.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, the FA Cup has lost quite a lot of its importance or prestige in today's football, but then it was huge. It was like the Super Bowl in England, you know, and everybody tuned into it. And if you got there, you're the centre of attention. So to win it was absolutely fantastic. And we bounced back after losing in 78 to Ipswich. We bounced back to win it, which made it that bit sweeter. And it was an unbelievable finish to that cup final. Yeah. We were 2-0 up. We were cruising. And then it all fell asunder. And all of a sudden we're 2-2. And we score in the final minute. Alan Sunderland, great cross for Graham Ricks. Gary Bailey comes for it, misses it, and Alan, the good opportunist that he was there waiting to side foot volley it in.
I mean, it did start with a good pass from someone else for Graham Ricks down that left-hand side, or was that just here, you have a go, I'm knackered?
Well, I ran about, I suppose, about 30, 35 yards with the ball, but my thought was get it in their half before we lose another goal. But Ricksy, you know, we had a great understanding, myself and Graham. And he came up on my outside very fast, you know, and clipped a lovely ball in. And then a ball that Bailey thought he was going to get, but it was kind of tempting him to come for it. Mm. And Alan and then side-footed it in. So there we go. That was my only winner's medal at Arsenal. We were never going to win the league, Andrew, because we just weren't strong enough. We didn't have the squad. We didn't have the resources. But we were a great cup team, and four cup finals, only to win one leaves a bit of a sour taste in the mouth, but at least we did get one over the line.
I mean, the following year, in 1980, there was the cup final against West Ham, and then, of course, the Cup Winners' Cup final against Valencia. But maybe lost in the mists of time, people just look at the results. They don't realize how many games you played that season. It's quite interesting to consider, you know, all the talk of player welfare these days, and, you know, are they being run to, you know, is there too much football? Are they being asked to do too much? And was it 70 games?
Yeah, 70 games.
70 games 70 in one season.
Yeah. They play, what do they play now? 38 league games, you know. And probably win, if you were to win the European Cup and the FA Cup, you could get 70. But the squads are so big now, aren't they, that they just rotate and they give players a rest. And you could maybe have an easy tie that you give your big players a rest and things like that. But in those days, those things didn't happen, you know. So we had to play. And by the time we got to West Ham and Valencia, although against Valencia, I thought we were very unlucky not to win the match in 90 minutes. Even going into extra time, I thought we were the better team. Against West Ham, we didn't really perform on the day. But it did. That season did catch up with us. It was a bridge too far.
It was a much smaller squad as well, though. You know, you don't have 25 players and three goalkeepers and, you know, a bunch of reserves and youth team players if you absolutely need them. It was, what, 15, 16 players?
Yeah, I would have said probably 14 players maybe shared the brunt of that 70 games. Like, I think I played 59, maybe 60. Brian Talbot, I think, played all of them. Can you imagine?
How do you do that physically? Like, how is... I mean, surely the players then... were experiencing some of the same injuries that players have now, but
well, from my memory,
all had hamstrings back then, right?
Yeah, but you know, we were fit, we were super fit, but and from my memory, you know, we didn't do any training. It was just like in massage, bath, maybe a walk around the pitch, maybe a jog around the pitch, a few stretches, home, you know, rest up. Got a game the next night, the same again the next day. So we kind of got through it with some difficulty. We didn't have anybody to give us a rub down, you know.
Yeah.
Terry Neal and Don Howe were doing it, hardly trained in that profession. And
Al Fields, the assistant manager, people.
And Al Fields, who was the assistant kit man, he was a great character, a former player, Alf, in the 30s and 40s. You know, he was probably the best at it, and you'd rather have Alf giving you a massage than Terry Neal or Don Howe, to be honest.
Right. Fair. I won't ask any more questions about that, but another point about, you know, football back then in the era that you played in, and there's a little story about how it could have been Ireland playing in England, at Wembley, and you stayed in a hotel and then had to go across the road to train in a local park.
Well, that's another subject, Andrew, to be quite honest. It's how poor the organisation was at international level if you were an Irish player.
Yeah.
They didn't have the money to spend, to be fair. They didn't think of spending it properly, you know, and we ended up, you know, we were a bit of a ragball Rovers outfit.
So at the time, you mentioned Arsenal didn't have the resources. There seemed to be a reluctance on the part of the club to acknowledge the way things were changing in football in terms of transfer fees and investment and that kind of stuff. And the reluctance to do that, I mean, you could have gone somewhere other than Juventus. In the book, you mentioned that Arsenal might have been happier for you to go to Manchester United because they would have got more money for you. But how determined were you maybe to challenge yourself as a player and go to Serie A at that time, which was probably seen as the best in terms of what European football or what European leagues had to offer?
Well, first of all, let's address the reasons why I wanted to leave. I wanted to leave because I felt the club hadn't looked after me financially. I think when you're a homegrown player, and it might have been the same for Charlie George, it was certainly the same for Frank Stapleton, who left after me, was that the club kind of took for granted the fact that you were a homegrown player. So you might get a player like Malcolm McDonald coming in from Newcastle for a record fee, or maybe Brian Talbot from Ipswich, and you knew that they were earning much more than the players who had grown up at the club. Now, that doesn't happen anymore, you know.
No.
Thankfully, that doesn't happen anymore. But so you've kind of got that in your mind. Then also the ambition of the club. You know, are they going to really want to challenge for the league? Are we going to spend the million on a transfer fee like Liverpool were doing, or Nottingham Forest were doing, or Manchester City were doing? No, we weren't. So that was factored in. And then I thought I was going to go to Germany and follow what Keegan had done, going to Hamburg. I thought I was going to Bayern Munich. But that fell through. And at that time, Italy opened up its football again to foreign players, because after 1966 World Cup here in England, Italy got knocked out by North Korea, which was a shock and a disgrace back in Italy. And they blamed there was too many foreign players in their league. So they stopped any more foreign players coming in until 1980. And then they opened it up again, and that's when Juventus targeted me and took me to Turin.
What were the big differences between not just Arsenal and Juventus, but maybe the English and Italian football cultures? Was it more tactical? Was there greater preparation in terms of the opposition you were going to play? Those kinds of things.
Yeah, I would have said, you know, the training was much the same. You know, I don't think Don Howe had any weaknesses when it came to tactics or compared to an Italian guy. It was certainly more technical. The game was more technical. It was slower. There was less of the ball in the air. It was played on the ground, whereas in England it was always kind of get it forward, you know, don't play out from the back, things like that. That was different. You got time on the ball in Italy. Unless you're a forward player playing in the last third of the pitch, in the middle of the pitch, you always had time on the ball, and that suited me. The league was only going to get better. At that time, the Italian players were very, very strong. You know, they won the... they won the World Cup in 1982, and so that tells you how good they were. And seven Juventus players were in that team. So when I joined in 1980, I was playing with some really top players. I would say more technical. Tactical, maybe, because it wasn't played so much in the air, so you had to do things to maybe break teams down or defend certain situations. Trapattoni was our coach then, and he was he's got to be one of the best people I've worked under.
You were obviously very successful at Juventus, but football is a ruthless business. And at the end of your second year, you were aware that the club were going to replace you with Michel Platini. I guess it didn't go down well at first, but how quickly do you come to terms with something like that when you realize, you know, it's not necessarily a personal thing. It's more about maybe the wishes of an owner or a manager and that kind of stuff.
Well, in my case, it was the owner, who was Gianni Agnelli, who was owner of Fiat and multi-billion-pound businesses in Italy. And if you want a comparison, a bit like Roman Abramovich when he was at Chelsea. You know, he wanted to have a couple of selections at least of who he fancied. And I think they were chasing Platini before me. So in my first year, we won the league. I did ever so well. The second year, again, doing well. We got knocked out of the European Cup, which was the holy grail for Juventus. They'd won plenty of leagues, but they never won the European Cup. And I probably think going out to Anderlecht then, Agnelli might have been thinking, well, if I can get Platini in, I'll get him in. I didn't expect it to happen. I didn't see it coming. And I was in a bit of a daze because I was told with a month to go before the end of the season, we were trying to win the league again. We were top of the league, head to head with Fiorentina then. And I just didn't see it coming. And I was in a bit of a shock for a few days, but I wasn't going to play for them. But my solicitor and you could call him an agent, Ronnie Tiemann. Ronnie said to me, look, you've got to finish out the season in the most professional way you can. So, knuckle down and play the last three games, and which we did. And we got 5 points from six, and we ended up pipping Fiorentina by a point.
Yeah, I mean, that be professional thing and finish out. You had a decisive role in those last three games with that penalty.
Yeah, and what I remember about those times, Andrew, is Paolo Rossi made us come back to Italian football after being banned. He trained with us all year at Juventus, and he played in that third last game against Udinese and actually scored in it. Then we drew at home to Naples 0-0. So it was still in the balance going to Catanzaro in the south of Italy, and we got a penalty and I scored it, and I left in the best possible circumstances.
Yeah. How determined were you to stay in Italy? Because you took to life there, learned the language.
Well, I was 2 years married, and initially I said, I don't want to stay here. If this is what they do to a player, is help them win, not one league, but two leagues, I want to go home. And Arsenal were home, was England to me, because, spent 10 years there. I wanted maybe to go back to English football. But my wife said to me, well, we've had 2 years in Italy. Why don't we try another club? Yeah. And she was right. So we had another 5 years in that wonderful country and that wonderful league.
Yeah, Sampdoria, Inter Milan, Ascoli, a move I think which you write about regretting because, perhaps the person in charge of that club wasn't as on the level as they should be. And then returning to England to West Ham. I know you did sort of broach the idea of coming back to Arsenal, but things were going on there with George Graham where he felt maybe you weren't the right fit.
Well, Ronnie Tiemann was my agent, but he was more of a solicitor than an agent, so he wasn't ringing managers up to see who was interested in bringing me, like goes on now. Agents contact clubs, don't they, and things like that. So I had friends in the press, a couple of not many in the press, a couple.
The ones that didn't
and
see
Reg Drury was a great journalist. Worked for the News of the World, soccer man through and through, loved his football. I always suspected he was Spurs, though, but he never admitted to having a team, but I always suspected he was Spurs man. But anyway, we were very good friends, and I said, Reg, can you ask George Graham, I'm getting out of here, will he have me back? And Reg said, he will. In those days, journalists can pick up the phone to a manager. Now, you probably have to go through the press office in the club, and you'd be lucky to get to speak on a one-to-one basis with a player or a manager. But those days was different. And Reg contacted George, and George said, no, I'm not interested, Reg. And it was quite obvious to me that George had in his mind he was going to go for younger players who were hungry, wanted success, the likes of Steve Bould, Nigel Winterburn, Ian Wright, So it didn't happen, and I played an international match for my country against Scotland, and I played all right, and John Lyle was at the match, the West Ham manager, and within a week I was out of Ascoli and back playing in London.
Did you enjoy West Ham?
Yeah, I liked West Ham. Yeah, yeah. It was great. Yeah, it was great. Great supporters, great atmosphere at the old Upton Park, and I thoroughly, John played the football I wanted to play. I really enjoyed it.
You had a big injury there, though, as well. You did your cruciate.
That kind of stopped me. I was only there like probably less than one season. And I was 31 when I ruptured my cruciate ligament, and I was out for nearly 10 months without being able to play. And that kind of, it limited to what I did for West Ham. I played okay, but when I came back from injury, you're not the same when you come back at 31 from a bad injury like that.
Particularly when maybe the techniques to repair that specific injury, which is a really serious one for a footballer, weren't as advanced as they are now.
Correct. You'd probably get over that injury in 4 or 5 months now with the advances that have been made in medically. And those days, it took you the best part of a year. And then you're coming back and you're not quite the same. You know, I didn't have a ligament replacement. They just tied my ligaments together, my old ones that were ruptured. They tied them together, told me to build up my thigh muscles to protect my knee. But, you know, that's hardly the way things are done now.
Now, do you remember the moment where you realized or decided that you were going to hang up your boots?
It was probably to do with Jack Charlton. You know, I had been a regular for Jack before my injury. And then, 10 months away from the Irish team, Jack moved on to other players. And when I realised I wasn't going to be in his plans, I kind of thought this would be a good time to retire. So I retired in 1990.
How was your relationship with Jack? Ups and downs?
Not really, mainly up. But yeah. When, he took me off after 30-odd minutes in a match against West Germany where we had a blazing row in the dressing room at half-time, and I called him a few choice words and he told me to shut up and, and then it was a bit frosty for a while, but we made up. He wrote me a nice letter saying, I retired straight away after that match because I knew I wasn't in his plans. He'd moved on to other players, so I didn't want to just be hanging around, hoping for a place even on the bench, So I hung up my boots. Jack wrote me a nice letter, and we repaired the problems we had, and I followed them to the 1990 World Cup as a pundit for the BBC, and 94 World Cup. So
what was that like in 1990, though, to see Ireland at a World Cup in Italy, your second home, if you like, well, third home, I guess, after Ireland, then England, then Italy, right? But to be within that sort of the proximity of your playing career, and then to sort of sit and watch, it must have been a little bit bittersweet.
It was, yeah. Obviously very pleased that we did so well. Like, Ireland get to quarterfinals, go out only by a single goal to the Italians in Rome. We had some great times. Ireland, Jack was a very functional manager. We weren't playing beautiful football by any means, but we were getting results, and he knew how to get results. But the whole country went absolutely berserk here, so... in Italy, I was there. I was as close as I could be without playing, because I was, in the best seats. I was in and around the dressing room after the games. I was in the hotel having a few drinks with the players. I had a ball, but there was quite a bit in my head saying, I wish I could have been here.
Yeah, for sure. There is stuff about your managerial career in the book, which I'll let people read, because I just want to move on and talk a little bit about your role at Arsenal and the head of youth development. What is the biggest challenge in that role? And I think what you did obviously set foundations at the football club that exist to this day, but the amount of talent that comes through at a young age, how difficult is it to spot the ones who are really going to make it? Because there are so many factors. A player can be maybe physically more dominant at a young age because they've matured maybe a little bit ahead of some of the other players. How hard is it to keep an eye on that, or how hard is it? How do you work through the process of identifying talent that you think is going to be able to make it for the first team at Arsenal, and if not at Arsenal, maybe go on and have a career somewhere else?
Well, it's not as detailed as you're describing, Andrew. It's a bit like you spread your net and you catch all these fish, and maybe, you know, three or four of them are going to really go all the way, you know. And maybe half of them will get a career in the game, and the other half might not, you know. So when you're looking at young lads of 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years of age, nobody knows for certain that they're going to be. But over the course of time, when you get to know the boys and girls now, because Arsenal have got an academy for girls as well, you recognise the ones who are dedicated and really want to make it, feet on the ground, as well as having the ability that's needed. But one, you can't do one and not the other, you know. You can be dedicated, but if you don't have the ability,
sure,
you'll only get so far. But if you have the ability and dedication, you can go all the way. And, well, we had quite a few go through the system. And we didn't have a training ground solely for the kids. So we created that, myself and Richard Carr, who's a great servant of the club as a director. Carr family have been in the club for donkey's years. We worked together to create a process where we could have great facilities for the boys, great organisation, good coaches. I had great staff working for me. David Court, ex-player, he was a great right-hand man to me. Roy Massey, he looked after the younger element in the academy. Many of them are in the first team now, you know. Roy recruited these kids at 7 and 8. Bukayo Saka, Emile Smith-Rowe, Eddie Nketiah, we got from Chelsea. Chelsea thought he wasn't that good. We recruited him. Reece Nelson. You know, they've all been at the club since they were, apart from Eddie, the other three have been at the club since they were 8 and 9. So we did a really good job, and, you know, we got the likes of Ashley Cole, Jack Wilshere, Kieran Gibbs, you know. It was hard to get in that Arsenal team when you were a youth player, because we were so good, weren't we? You know, Arsene Wenger's years. Like he find a midfield to replace Patrick Vieira wasn't easy.
No, this is still an ongoing process, I think. What changed when you were able to bring in younger players from across Europe? Because that wasn't always part of the process. But then you have, you know, players like Cesc Fabregas, Hector Bellerin, who came in, Sebastian Svard, people like that, who, you know, the Swedish guys, Seb Larsson, for example. Did they bring something to the academy dynamic that was, you know, tangible?
Well, Arsene was ahead of the game. He was ahead of the game in bringing in all those great French players. You know, everyone copied him, you know, within 2 or 3 years after that. You know, but when I remember having a meeting with him and Steve Rowley, who was chief scout at the time, and Arsene said, "I want you to scout for young players outside of England." He said, "This is a European game now, you know, and let's look outside of Ireland, England, Scotland and Wales," which was traditionally the way things were done. And we did, you know. Steve Rowley brought in some great young players. I brought in some really, really good players. I think Steve's outfit brought in Cesc Fabregas. He's got to be the best foreign player we brought in as a kid, without any doubt, you know. But we had as you mentioned, Seb Larsson. I thought he maybe could have got a better run out at Arsenal. I think he was maybe overlooked a little bit, but, you know, there wasn't many that Arsene missed. Nicholas Bentner, we all chuckle when we talk about Nicholas, but he could have been a really, really good player. But unfortunately, Nicholas didn't have that dedication I'm talking about.
That's what I was asking.
Yeah.
You know, I interviewed him, last year, maybe the year before, when his book came out. And, you know, he did sort of acknowledge that he could have been a bit more professional, I suppose, during his time at Arsenal, and maybe at other clubs as well. But is that just sometimes the character of a player? That
was his personality, his character. You know, I probably had him in my office more for disciplinary reasons than anything else, you know, and I'm sure Arsene had problems with him as well. But if you look at his record for Denmark and how many goals he scored, you know, he's a highly talented lad, but he just didn't have the dedication that's needed. You know, it was a shame. You know, I think he could have been a really good player.
So let me just sort of finish up by asking you what you make of Arsenal at the moment, and how much you're enjoying maybe the revitalization of the club and the team, because it was, you know, for a few years it was quite fraught and the atmosphere wasn't great and there were a lot of complaints about all kinds of things, but everybody appears to be singing from the same hymn sheet to a large extent now that the process that Mikel Arteta has put in place looks like it's paying dividends. So what do you make of how the club and the team have come through that period to get to where we are now? And I mean, did you enjoy last season?
I did. I really enjoyed last season, particularly the first half of it, you know, where we were outstanding.
Yeah.
Some of the football we played was really brilliant, you know, and scoring goals and beating teams, and sometimes the game would be over before, you know, half an hour, you know, we were so good. But then it came down to resources in the end, injuries, suspensions, we lost some very important players, and you kind of knew we weren't going to see the distance out. You know, if it was a racehorse, we were going to start flagging the last two furlongs to go, you know. So it was a pity, really. But I think Arteta's done a really good job. He's rejuvenated the team, hasn't he? You know, he's made it a young team. It's an up-and-coming team, with a lot of talent, playing really good football. And, of course, I'm loving the fact that Hale End is making a good contribution to what's going on.
Yeah, I was going to ask you just finally, who do you enjoy watching the most in this team? And I'd sort of written down Martin Odegaard, because, you know, I'm guessing that left foot is something you could connect with, but also the left foot of Bukayo Saka, you know, being that Hale End graduate and becoming a huge star for Arsenal.
Yeah, both those players I enjoy watching. I must admit, I wasn't too sure about Odegaard when we bought him, but he's proven me wrong. You know, we all have opinions, and it's nice when they change for the better. I think Odegaard has been tremendous. And Saka, I think he's one of the most exciting players they've had at Arsenal for many, many years, haven't they? You know, and the bigger the challenge, he seems to handle it, you know. I'd like to see Emile Smith Rowe get a bit more time. But then again, that's my Hale End hat.
Well, he's an exciting player. He's a fun player to watch, isn't he? He's sort of got something a bit like there's something a little bit old school about the way he plays.
Yeah, I think he's a very intelligent player. He keeps the game moving. I think he can make goals. I think he'll score goals. I think he just needs an opportunity. But then, you know, if you're getting results like we are. How many games have we played now? Six wins and two draws, is it? Is that right, Andrew? Or could be seven, maybe?
10 games we've played.
Is it?
I think so.
Won seven, drawn three, I don't know. You should know
two.
This.
I should know. We've drawn two anyway. We drew the Derby and drew Fulham, so it must... I can't remember. I should look at the...
I think we've won either six or seven, put it that way. You know, so you can't say, well, the team has not been picked right, you know.
Yeah.
Arteta's doing really good stuff. I thought, although there's a lack of goal-mouth incident against Manchester City, it was good to see him out-tactic Guardiola. I thought that was very enjoyable.
Yeah, you enjoyed that game?
I really enjoyed it, yeah. I really enjoyed it because I didn't feel at any time we were going to lose it.
Which makes a change, doesn't it?
Well, whereas the one that was probably the decider the year before when Manchester City we started great. The first half hour, we could have been maybe one or two up. When we didn't capitalize on those chances, you just kind of knew something was going to go wrong because they were so good and things like that. And we were maybe a little bit nervous. But I think this time round, we showed that, you know, if they want to play it their way, we can play that way as well.
Bit of versatility. Well, look, the book is called Born to Be a Footballer. As always, it's a pleasure talking to you, Liam. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Thank you so much to Liam Brady. If you are looking to get a copy of the book in your local to Arsenal, they're stocking it in the Armory. Liam did a bit of a signing there after the Manchester City game, and I'm sure they still have copies in there. Or, of course, you can get it from your local independent bookshop, who will be happy to order it in for you if they don't have it in stock. It'll only take a couple of days. Support your local bookshops and get your copy of Born to Be a Footballer by Liam Brady there. Right, I'm going to leave it there. We will look ahead to the Chelsea game in a bit more detail in our preview podcast on Patreon. That will be Friday afternoon. So please do join us for that. If you're not already a member, you can sign up at patreon.com/arsblog. For now, hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you so much, as always, for being with us, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.